Yes, I did, she said seriously, because I've considered it and have concluded that the Makeout Rock is the most romantic place in the world to have a first kiss. Well, I said, who am I to argue with the world's most romantic time-traveling rock? I was awestruck by my good fortune and by this profoundly gorgeous girl who was staring at me in the moonlight. And then she stepped forward, and her lips parted mine, and nothing else mattered. Not that we were sick and might never get better, not that we'd miss so much and would miss more still, and not that the band around her wrist wasn't a corsage, but a med sensor. The world melted, and it was just us, in the woods, our mouths pressed together, as we found the kiss that had been waiting for us since we were 13. Well, she said. Well, I said. I guess now I have your TB, she joked. I guess now I have your first kiss. Took you long enough, Sadie said, biting her lip and staring up at me. There's a second kiss with your name on it, too, but it'll have to wait, or we'll be late for lights out. And even though I could have stayed there forever, her hand grabbed mine, and we hurried back through the woods toward the soft, warm glow of the cottages.
Chapter 14. Sadie. I couldn't sleep after we got back from the woods. I lay awake under the two warm covers, my whole body thrumming in the aftermath of that kiss. I felt the ghost of where his lips had been, and remembered the pressure of his hand on my back, the smell of his soap, the way his mouth had tasted faintly of apples. I didn't care that I'd promised myself I'd stay away from Latham boys, that I'd rolled my eyes whenever I saw other couples sneak off toward the woods or duck behind buildings to engage in Latham's favorite pastime. I didn't care about any of that. I just wanted to tiptoe over to Cottage 6 in my pajamas and push open the door to Lane's room and crawl under the covers with him so the feeling of our lips touching never had to end. Kissing Lane was like the first time you hear a song that you'll listen to on repeat 100 times. It was like the first spoonful of ice cream of the whole cup, but mostly, it was the strange and lovely experience of something being even better than I'd imagined. What were the odds that out of the 150 of us at Latham, there'd be a boy whose smile did flippy things to my stomach, and who liked me back, and who made jokes about Harry Potter? And what were the odds that it would be a boy I'd known and had wrongly despised for years? I'd been at Latham long enough that I no longer quite believed in second chances. But in the moments before I drifted off to sleep that night, I wondered if maybe Lane was the miracle Latham had promised, and if that miracle would be big enough. Lane was waiting on the porch the next morning. He bounded out of the glider when he saw me, this big, goofy grin on his face. His hair was wet from the shower, and he was wearing these horrible athletic shorts with a giant Aeropostale logo on the leg. Really? I said, making a face at the shorts. Hey, you already kissed me, no takebacks, he joked, and then he leaped down the porch steps two at a time. It was just a small thing, but it struck me how much healthier he looked than when he'd arrived, how the nurse never seemed to stay in his room very long when we hid our phones during lights out, and how he rolled his eyes after a coughing fit, instead of struggling to catch his breath. I wondered what I'd do if he left, when he left without me. Maybe it hadn't occurred to him since I never seemed that sick, and I wasn't. Month after month, my x-rays and blood tests came back the same, and I didn't know which change would be more terrifying, the death sentence I'd been dreading since sophomore year, or the ticket home to a life I'd missed far too much of to ever fully recover, and a world that would always treat me as an outsider if they knew. All I knew was that Lane was smiling at me, and even if it wasn't too late to back away, I wouldn't have been able to.
So, can I walk you to breakfast?
Lane asked. He looked so earnest and so excited about walking with me to the dining hall that I had to laugh. This plan of yours will never work, you know, I told him.
What plan?
The plan to fatten me up and feed me to the circus elephants.
I'll keep that in mind,
he said.
In the meantime, pancakes.
In the meantime, pancakes. And then I took the porch steps two at a time, copying him, and pretending it didn't make my chest ache.
I hadn't thought that breakfast would be weird or different that morning, but I could feel people staring as Lane and I waited in line, staring at us. At first, I thought something horrible must have happened, but Nick and Charlie were at the front of the line, and I'd seen Marina in the bathroom 10 minutes ago trying to even out her gel liner.
What's going on? Lane whispered, confused. Your shorts are just that terrible, I said, reaching for the muffin tray.
I've got it.
He held it out to me with a flourish.
Mademoiselle, quelque chose du sucre?
I melted into a puddle, and when I was done melting, he was still there and still smiling at me from behind the platter of lopsided cafeteria muffins. I can't ever tell if the droopy ones taste better or worse, I said.
So much better, Lane said. Droopy muffins for the win.
That would be an awesome insult, I said. Don't go out with her. She has a droopy muffin. We laughed, and behind us someone huffed impatiently. It was Angela. She narrowed her eyes at me. Can I help you? I asked. Take your time, Angela said, smiling sweetly. I just wanted to remind you both that it's impossible to walk with the Lord when you're lying down. For a second, I had no idea what she was talking about. And then I burst out laughing. Oh, wow, I said. Thank you for calling me a slut in the New Testament. That's super nice of you. I glanced over at Lane, who was still holding the muffin tray and trying so hard not to laugh that he was red in the face. Angela spluttered but didn't say anything else. I made sure to take extra long in the line just to annoy her. I caught some of the other girls from French class staring at us as well. And then I realized. Everyone had been at the movies last night. They'd all seen Lane and me flirting and holding hands and lying next to each other in our blanket nest, and they'd watched as we'd disappeared into the woods together. I hadn't considered what it looked like we'd done much more than we actually did, and like we were being obvious about it, wanting everyone to know what we were up to, and I hadn't realized quite how many girls had been set on Lane until they were glaring at us from behind their yogurt bowls, eyes narrowed in resentment. When Lane and I got to our table, he hesitated, then switched to the empty seat next to mine. He kept bumping my leg under the table with his, which was the cutest thing ever. I expected Nick to sulk about it, like he'd been doing ever since the Starbucks trip. But thankfully, he was too hungover to do anything besides groan and attempt the world's tiniest forkfuls of eggs.
You need to drink some water, Charlie told him.
Nick, who appeared not to have heard, swallowed thickly and lifted a forkful of eggs toward his mouth like someone had dared him to eat a snail. And then Marina rolled her eyes and imitated him, sending us all into hysterics. It was gorgeous outside that morning, Indian summer. The sky was a cloudless blue, and it felt like the school year was almost over instead of just beginning. It would have been a shame to go inside and waste one of the last warm days, so we stood around on the grass trying to figure out what to do.
We should go to the hill, Marina finally suggested.
So we did. The hill was this slope on the far side of the lake with a view of the grounds. It wasn't quite a hill, but that didn't matter. Charlie brought his portable record player, and Marina brought a deck of cards, and we all had books in our bags, although Lane and I were the only ones who actually tried to read them. We sat there all morning in the soft, warm grass listening to Charlie's collection of psychedelic pop records and teaching Lane how to play Egyptian rat screw. Nick, who was apparently in agony, put his cardigan over his face and went to sleep. Charlie and Marina took turns dropping handfuls of grass onto his stomach and laughing when he finally woke up and noticed. It was so wonderful, the five of us sitting there, and I wanted every day to be like this. To be us, in the sunshine, in no hurry to be anywhere else. After a while, Lane and I took a walk down to the lake. There was a single paddle boat at the water's edge. It was chained there, half sunken and rotting away.
This is one sad metaphor of a boat,
Lane said, pointing at it. You're right. It's a metaphor, which is like a simile,
I joked, and he playfully shoved me.
You're going in the lake,
he warned.
You're coming with me, I promised. Even though he was so much taller, he could probably pick me up and toss, like I was a frisbee.
I'll take my chances,
he said, menacing toward me, and I shrieked and ran up the little slope to the nearest bench, trying not to cough. He sat down next to me, looking contrite.
Sorry, he said. I wouldn't really throw you in the lake.
Except as a metaphor. I couldn't resist.
Oh, you're really gonna get it.
And then Lane was kissing me again, his hand cupping the side of my face. They say your skin is the largest organ in your body, but I'd never really appreciated that before. The way his fingertips, slowly tracing the curve of my jaw, could travel down the entire length of my body, covering me in goosebumps. The way he could make me feel flushed with something that wasn't a fever.
Listen,
Lane said.
I want to ask you something.
He cleared his throat nervously, and I was so afraid of what he might say that all sorts of terrible questions flashed through my brain.
Would you go on a date with me?
He looked so nervous about it, like he thought there was a chance I'd refuse. I think that would be okay, I said. He grinned triumphantly and scooped me onto his lap, and he was so tall and messy-haired and perfect. And he really was asking me out this time. It wasn't some mean prank by the girls in my cabin. So where are we going on this illustrious date? I asked. The dining hall, the library.
I was thinking Fall Fest, he said. Next Friday night?
I had no idea what he was talking about. Latham didn't have a Fall Fest. We had, like, decorative gourd painting and a screening of Hocus Pocus. And then I realized.
You mean in Whitley?
I asked. Lane nodded, holding back a grin.
I remembered the flyers from when we were there last time.
What happened to, Mr., there are 100 reasons why we shouldn't go to town, and I will stubbornly stand here listing them all? I asked.
Well, Lane said, I realized that was no way to impress a girl.
The rest of the week was the way summer camp should have been, the way my life should have gone 4 years ago if only either of us had been brave enough or bold enough to say hello back then. It was a week of board games on the porch and frozen fruit bars from the commissary and trading flash drives full of music. We read paperbacks on our stomachs in the grass after dinner and watched the sunset over the lake and ducked into the woods to kiss. Every night on the phone, we'd read each other the funny parts from our books or talk about the TV shows we'd watched as kids or what we would do if we were really there in each other's beds, except mostly joking. We said absurd things like how I'd suck the back of his knee or he'd run his toes through my hair and pretended they sounded amazing. The warm weather was gone by Friday, and that evening was foggy and cold. I had to abandon the cute dress I was going to wear in favor of jeans and my green parka. When Lane picked me up, he was wearing this black fleece jacket zipped up to his chin, and I joked that he looked like a Dracula.
A Dracula?
He asked.
Like one of the many Draculas?
Shut up.
I want to suck your Type A blood. The other Dracula over there, he is interested in Type B.
Lane went on in this ridiculous Count Chocula voice.
Oh my God, I'm going to kill you, I said, laughing.
We set off into the woods. I was in charge of navigating us down to Whitley, and at one point Lane looked around, confused.
I remembered it being that way, he said, pointing.
We'd veered a little farther west than I'd thought and were almost at the place where I usually met Michael. He was pointing even more west, which wasn't right.
It's this way, I said and explained where we were.
So you just picked a random point in the woods to meet some strange dude?
I didn't pick it, I said. And I explained about how Philip had run the black market before Nick. I inherited it, and anyway, he and Michael were like half cousins or something.
We were almost there, and I took out my bag of cough drops and passed one to Lane.
"Do these actually work?"
he asked. "Yes, and you're cured now," I teased. "You're welcome.
How can I ever thank you?"
Lane got this mischievous grin on his face and pulled me toward him for a kiss that tasted like cherry medicine. And then his hands were in my hair, and his tongue was against mine, and I accidentally swallowed my cough drop. It wasn't much farther into town, and when we got there, the main street looked so festive with lights in the trees and all the shop windows decorated for fall. The street was blocked off to traffic and crowded with booths, and a jazz band of old dudes was playing in the old gazebo. There were rides, too, a miniature Ferris wheel and a giant slide and a chair swing. It reminded me of the county fair and how I used to go with my mom and sister, enviously watching as other girls my age roamed around in friend groups.
"Reminds me of my school carnival,"
Lane said with a lopsided grin.
"Fancy school," I teased.
He shrugged.
"I never went to the thing anyway. They always had teachers in the dunking booth."
I didn't know what he meant at first, but then I remembered how he'd said his dad taught at his school. "Then we have to make up for all the carnivals you missed," I said, dragging him toward the line for ride tickets. Everything was pretty expensive, so we just got tickets for the swing ride. "You have to try and grab my hand while we're in the air," I said. "That's the rule."
"What do I win if I do?"
Lane asked. "A wish," I promised. It was exhilarating going on the ride and lifting into the air, my feet dangling beneath me. You could see a lot from up there. The road that led to Latham, the bell tower through the trees, and the neat yards of the houses in town. It was strange seeing both worlds at once, mine and the real one. The swings were pretty far apart, but Lane still tried, twisting around in his seat and looking back at me with his hand outstretched. I leaned forward, too, as far as I could, but we could never quite reach.
"Guess I didn't get my wish,"
Lane teased as we staggered off the ride. "Don't worry, it wasn't a very big wish," I assured him. "It was like a medium soda of a wish."
"Well, now you've ruined it, and I know I'm missing out on a medium soda."
"Or possibly half a plain funnel cake," I said.
"Or possibly half a plain funnel cake," he repeated in mock despair.
Lane held my hand as we wandered through the booths, and then he bought us apple ciders. They were too hot to drink, so we sat on the hay bales outside the pumpkin patch, waiting for them to cool off. It felt strange being in town, but it always did. I hadn't lived in this world for so long that it was weird to see that people were still drinking green juice and taking out their phones whenever they had to stand in line. "This is so nice," I said, and then I sipped the cider and made a face. "Ow! Hot."
"Still?
Why don't you try it and find out?"
"I'm not falling for that one," Lane said, laughing.
Nearby, little kids ran through the pumpkin patch, hyper from sugar and covered in face paint. I leaned my head against Lane's shoulder, thinking about my sister, who was 12. Too old to be enthusiastic about this stuff, but still young enough to dress up and get free candy.
"What was your worst Halloween costume?"
Lane asked me. "I was Hermione Granger, like, 5 years in a row," I said. "By the time that was over, I'd gone through my embarrassing years."
"I was a gorilla once,"
he told me.
"You were not," I laughed.
"I was," he insisted. "I think I was 5. I saw the costume in one of those Halloween castles, you know, those stores that pop up for a few months and then disappear."
I nodded.
"Anyway, that was it. Gorilla. So my mom took me trick-or-treating, and she made me go really early just to the houses on our block. And that year it was like 80 degrees out."
He glanced over at me with this lopsided grin,
which means it was at least 100 degrees in that thick, hairy gorilla suit. The mask was off by the third house, and then the feet, and then the gloves. And after 10 minutes, I was standing there covered in sweat and crying in this hairy black jumpsuit wanting to go home.
We both laughed. I tried to picture 5-year-old Lane in a hairy gorilla suit, and it was surprisingly easy. I'd known him when we were 13, after all.
"I want to see a picture," I insisted.
"Fine, then I want to see you in that Hogwarts uniform."
He raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, my my God, I was 10. Hey, you were pretty cute at 13, he teased. It wasn't true, though. I'd been skinny and frizzy-haired at 13 with weird-shaped boobs, like cones. But it was still nice of him to say. Our ciders had cooled down enough, so we sipped them, watching the sunset and listening to the terrible music that drifted from the bandstand. I bet they sell kettle corn, I said.
I bet you're right, Lane said.
I'll go get us some. Lane asked if I wanted him to come with me, but I shook my head. I didn't want it to seem like I was forcing him to buy me kettle corn, too. I'll be right back, I promised. And then I did something I hadn't had the pleasure of doing in a long time. I disappeared into the crowd. I felt so free, even with the med sensor around my wrist, like I wasn't making the best of Latham, but was actually doing something 17-year-olds did for real. I was on a date with a cute boy, and he'd bought me apple cider and told me an embarrassing story about when he was 5, and afterward, maybe we'd make a detour in the woods so I could show off my seriously uncomfortable blue lace bra, and then we'd smooth down our hair and he'd walk me to my front porch and kiss me goodnight. I found the kettle corn lady and bought a bag. I couldn't resist eating some on the way back. The kernels scratched at my throat, and I ducked into a little alleyway between two shops, trying not to cough on anyone. I was just catching my breath when a side door opened and these 3 preppy-looking bros in ball caps and boat shoes staggered outside. It was the back door to a bar, I guessed, since it was dark inside and I could hear a sports game playing on some television. The guys were college-aged, and they stared at me in this uncomfortable way that I thought was only reserved for girls in tight dresses, and not girls in jeans and striped shirts. I was still coughing, and the blonde one walked over, laughing. "Hey, you okay?" he asked. "Kettle corn," I said, trying to catch my breath.
"You want to come back and sign? I'll buy you a drink," he said.
I realized he thought I'd been in the bar, which made sense because I was standing right outside. I shook my head. "I have to meet someone," I said.
"We'll walk you," the guy said, suddenly pushy. "Won't we?"
His friends nodded and said that, yeah, it was no trouble. They'd walk me.
That's okay.
I started to edge away, and he sort of blocked me.
What's wrong? The guy asked. You don't want to talk to us anymore?
I glanced toward the passage that led back onto the street. I told you, I'm meeting someone, I said firmly, and then I walked away.
Come on, beautiful, where are you going?
One of them shouted. Without looking back, I knew they were following me. I could hear their footsteps behind me in the alley, but forced myself not to turn around. I could feel the panic rising in my throat as they followed me through the edge of the Fall Fest. I didn't know how to make them leave me alone, and I didn't want to get anyone else's attention because they might ask questions about me.
Come on, we're really nice. Just stop a second,
one of them said. I whirled around. I told you no. I said sharply, "Go away." They laughed. They were so close and so much bigger than me, and they didn't seem to comprehend how terrible they were acting.
But we said we'd walk you, the tallest one said, and a gentleman never breaks his word.
Then be a gentleman and stop following me, I insisted. And then I started coughing. It was pretty bad, and I hadn't been expecting it. The stupid kettle corn had been my worst idea ever. When I caught my breath, the tallest one had taken a step back.
Whoa, that sounds pretty serious, he said.
I have asthma, I said defensively.
Didn't sound like asthma,
the blonde one said, smiling like he enjoyed taunting me.
Sounded contagious. You're not going to give us the plague, are you, Blondie?
Not if you leave me alone, I said, whirling around. But his hand shot out and he grabbed my wrist. I twisted away and my parka pulled back, relieving my med sensor and its blinking green light. They all stared at it, and at me.
Oh, shit, the blonde one said. She's from that creepy hospital. We could have fucking TB now,
his bearded friend said.
What the fuck? Wait, she said she was meeting someone. There's more of them here,
the tall guy said. My heart was hammering. I didn't know what to do. If I went back to Lane, they'd follow me. And if I tried to get someone's help, I'd be in an even bigger mess. I was Frankenstein's monster, Typhoid Mary, the guy who kept sneezing really loudly on an airplane. I stared at them in horror, and then I heard a boy's voice.
What the hell are you doing?
It was Michael, with his work boots and tattoos, walking toward us. I'd never seen him look so angry or so intimidating as he frowned at the three drunken bros.
I asked you a question, he demanded. She's one of those contagious kids from the TB place on the hill, the blonde guy said. And there's more of them here.
I stared at Michael, pleading silently for him to vouch for me.
That's ridiculous, he said. This is my cousin. Your cousin?
One of the guys asked, frowning. I'm Philip's little sister, I lied. They looked unsure. I'm 15, I said, making my eyes wide and scared. That at least got through to them.
Shit,
the bearded one muttered, believing me.
What are you doing in a bar?
The tall one said. Michael glared at me. I wasn't in a bar. I was standing outside eating kettle corn, and they started harassing me, I said.
You're drunk, Michael told them, and bothering underage girls. So you can stop lying about how and why that happened. Go home, sober up, and read Jezebel.
Michael stalked off, and I followed him gratefully. Thank you, I said. He whirled around, still upset.
I didn't do it for you. I did it for business,
he said. Yeah, okay.
You can't keep doing this,
he said.
Those guys were about to turn this place upside down until they found your friends. You have to stop coming down here. You're going to infect everyone.
We are not. We're just sitting by the pumpkin patch, I said. The color drained from his face.
My kid's over there,
he said. You have a kid? I asked.
Yes, I have a kid,
Michael said angrily.
He's 2 and a half, and if anything happens to him, I swear to God, if I see you in town again, I'll turn you in myself. Now get your friends and get the hell out of here.
Fine, I said, stalking off. It wasn't fair. Those beer-sloshing bros were the ones putting everyone in danger, not me. I wasn't even doing anything. I wasn't even near anyone. But I believed it then, what Amit had said about leaving Latham. There were people out there who panicked, and all it took was one to start a witch hunt. Lane looked worried when I got back to the hay bales.
That took a while, he said. Everything okay?
I didn't want Lane to freak out. He looked so hopeful and so happy that I couldn't say anything and ruin our date. So I rolled my eyes and held up the kettle corn. The line took forever, I said. Everyone had the same idea. We should probably head back, though, since it's getting late.
Yeah, of course.
And then he followed me back toward the old hiking path. I dug into my purse for my flashlight and compass and handed him the kettle corn. We ate as we walked back, not caring that it made us cough. And when we came to the rock in the woods, which almost looked like the one from camp, I was much calmer. Nothing bad had really happened. It was just some drunk guys deciding that my walking around and being female was an invitation for creepery. That sort of thing went on all the time. And to be fair, it wasn't like they were still afraid of me after the doctor said my TB was inactive. I was a pale, sick-looking stranger with a bad cough. Of course they were on their guard. But it was over now, nothing to worry about, and I wasn't going to let it ruin my first real date with a boy. A cute boy. Who'd bought me cider and held my hand and been a complete gentleman. Lane stared at the rock, and so did I. I bet you'll never guess what color my bra is, I said.
Probably not, he said. But I know one way to find out.
Chapter 15. Lane. My first month at Latham House came to a close, although it seemed wrong to measure time like that, to consider the start of my days at Latham to be something that didn't have to do with Sadie Bennett. I talked to my parents on the phone every few nights, and when they asked me how I was sleeping and how was I feeling and what had I been up to, I actually answered them. I figured I owed them some assurance that I wasn't lying on my deathbed 400 miles away, trying to keep up with my AP Euro packet. And the weird thing was, they were enthusiastic when I said I'd made friends in my French class and that we played cards and traded books. And they didn't seem to mind when I said I'd put aside my schoolwork to focus on getting better. The longer I was away, the more my specific annoyances with them faded. Sure, they'd always been strict, but I'd never given any indication that I wasn't happy with the way things were. I'd wanted to be the best as much as they'd wanted it for me. I'd been the one who had decided to give up drama class to take AP Art History my freshman year. It wasn't like I'd discussed it with them or pleaded to keep taking drama. I'd been convinced it was a necessary sacrifice, and they'd praised me for making a mature decision. Before I even knew what high school was, I'd already let my fear of not being the best at it make me miserable. And I was starting to think that if I hadn't gotten sick, I would have done the same thing with college, rushing toward internships and grad school and a job. Somehow, without realizing, I'd made high school into a race toward the best college as opposed to its own destination. It was only now that I hadn't done the same thing at Latham that I could see it, and that I realized how unhappy it made me. The last SAT date for early admission passed. I don't know what I was doing that day. Lying in a field of overgrown grass, reading a Douglas Adams novel on my stomach. Pulling Sadie behind a building to kiss her on the way back from wellness. Lounging in bed in the middle of the afternoon, listening to Charlie's records through the open windows while the shadows of tree branches played across my wall. Whatever I was doing that day, I wasn't hunched over a too small desk in a high school gym with a plastic bag of sharpened pencils trying to raise my score another 30 points, even though it was already in the 99th percentile. I wasn't terrified that if I screwed up a single question, my entire future might disappear. Probably, I was wondering if Sadie and I could slip off somewhere after dinner, and what else we'd slip off. We were in French class when it happened. Sadie was sitting under the window reading a John Green novel, and I'd slid her worksheet onto my desk and was busy filling it in with the most hilariously wrong answers I could think of since I'd already finished mine. It was almost lunch, and I was starving. I kept hoping my stomach wouldn't growl and give me away. Mr. Finnegan was at his desk for once when this kid Carlos pushed open the door. Carlos wasn't in our class, and Finnegan looked up from his iPad with a frown. "Everyone's supposed to go to the gym immediately," Carlos said. The whole class looked around confused. It was Tuesday morning, and as far as I could tell, it was a pretty unusual request.
"The gym?"
Mr. Finnegan repeated.
"Immediately," Carlos said.
Our teacher thanked the kid, who disappeared out into the hallway. And then Finnegan shrugged and told us to stop working.
"Are we coming back?"
Nick asked. But Finnegan didn't know, so some of us took our bags and most of us left our books open on our desks. Everyone was in the gym, spread thinly across the rows of bleachers which were meant for far more than 150 of us. I remember Sadie making some jokes about it being a terrible time for a pep rally, and Nick chiming in about how come nobody told him we had a basketball team. I was too nervous and too confused to say anything. I didn't know what was going on, and I hated that. There were adults I'd never seen standing around the edges of the gym, teachers and nurses, which felt ominous, like whatever was going to happen was so bad that they thought we might try to escape. Dr. Behrens and this administrative lady, Mrs. Kleefeld, who'd given my parents my admissions forms, were discussing something behind an ancient wheeled lectern.
"What's going on?"
Sadie whispered, and I shrugged. Some young tech-looking guy was helping to set up,
and the microphone came to life with a squeal and then static. Everyone clapped their hands over their ears, making a much bigger deal of it than it actually was. Latham had never felt so much like a high school as it did then. Except for the small fact that most high schools have a survival rate higher than 80%. Mrs. Kleefeld angled the microphone down and smiled tensely at us. Her pearl necklace was so tight that it almost looked like it was choking her. "Good afternoon, children," she said, which seemed like the wrong word to use, although I didn't know what might have been the right one. She paused, as though waiting for us all to chant, "Good afternoon, Mrs. Kleefeld," back at her, but we didn't. I glanced at the clock on the wall, which read 11:23. Not afternoon, but still morning. "As you know," Mrs. Kleefeld continued, "being at Latham House is a special privilege. The data that your medical sensors collect has helped scientists to understand so much about your illness. And these scientists have been working day and night to make advances in the treatment of total drug-resistant tuberculosis. We thought it best to gather everyone here as quickly as possible to avoid the spread of rumors and false information. I suppose I should let Dr. Behrens explain." Everyone else looked as confused as I felt, and then Dr. Behrens stepped behind the podium. He wasn't wearing his white coat, just a fleece jacket a lot like mine, and it was strange seeing him in a high school gym and not a medical building. The only thing we'd done so far in here was to watch movies, and I was pretty sure he wasn't announcing a surprise screening of The Goonies. "Thank you, Mrs. Kleefeld," he began, and then cleared his throat nervously. "There has been news this morning that the FDA has classified a serum called protosilin as a first-line treatment for total drug-resistant tuberculosis. The protosilin has been approved for clinical testing and is moving forward into production." The gymnasium was silent, hanging on his every word. He couldn't be saying what I thought he was saying. "And as of 30 minutes ago, it has been confirmed that the first doses of protosilin will be ready in 6 weeks, and that Latham House will be participating in the initial trial." He paused and beamed at us. "What this means is that in 6 weeks' time, the TDR strain of tuberculosis will be curable." There was a moment of stunned silence, and then the gym erupted in whoops and cheers. All around me, people were laughing and hugging and crying. Genevieve and her crowd were on their knees, thanking God for inventing science, I guessed. I couldn't believe I'd been so wrong about why they'd gathered us in the gym. It wasn't something bad at all. It was something incredible. "Sadie," I said, turning toward her. "Oh my God," she said, fighting back tears. We hugged each other close, and she sniffled into my shoulder as I struggled to wrap my head around the idea that we were going to be cured. All of us. Not temporarily stable, but having to take it easy to avoid a relapse. Cured. Forever. In no time at all, I'd be transported back to my former life, and Latham would melt away like a bad dream. Except it wasn't a bad dream. It was card games in the grass and stolen internet, and Sadie in that green dress, and Charlie's records and subtitled Japanese movies, and Marina doing an impression of Nick eating scrambled eggs. It wasn't the life I'd wanted, but it was the life I had, and I was finally starting to accept that. "If I can have everyone's attention," Dr. Behrens said, and the gym gradually quieted. "I'm sure you have a lot of questions, and I'm going to attempt to answer some of them now. Your parents will be notified over the next few hours by our medical staff. Protosilin will be administered by daily injection over the course of 8 weeks. For the first 4 weeks, you will stay here so that any side effects and symptoms can be monitored and recorded. After that time, arrangements will be made with hospitals in your area so you can continue receiving daily observed treatment at home for the rest of the course. Your hall nurses will be distributing more information to you and to your parents as soon as it becomes available. And we'll be temporarily suspending phone and internet access until everyone's parents have been contacted by our staff. Dr. Behrens went on, thanking us all for listening and saying what an honor it was to share this news with us.
Look at Finnegan, Sadie whispered. I glanced over. Finnegan and his wife, who was wearing scrubs, were holding each other so tightly that it looked painful. I'd never seen him so happy. Actually, I'd never seen Latham House so happy. I hadn't noticed before quite how grim everyone was, even if it was a cheerful, morbid sort of grimness. We were all trapped on the same hellish island together, except now, in the distance, someone had sighted a lifeboat.
Chapter 16. Sadie. I hated that there was a voice in the back of my head telling me it wasn't true, but for whatever reason, I couldn't quite believe that protosilin was real. All I could think about were the last two times scientists had claimed they'd created a serum that cured tuberculosis. The first time, one of the guys on Nick's Hall had found it on the internet and printed out the Daily Mail article, and it was all over Latham by dinner, except it turned out to be a hoax. A researcher in Korea had faked the data, and the next morning there were at least a dozen articles accusing him of fraud. That was during my sixth month at Latham House. And then a few months later, rumors had spread about a new super drug. I'd let myself hope, only to be disappointed again when it failed miserably in lab testing. So I didn't want to get my hopes up for protosilin, even if it did seem real this time, even if it was all over the news that afternoon. I stood around the common room with everyone else, glued to the television, as reports trickled in that a group of scientists at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania had developed a first-line treatment for the previously total drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis. That this was the first new tuberculosis treatment in 50 years, and the first major medical breakthrough to treat an infectious disease in what doctors were now definitively calling the post-antibiotic era. Someone would switch the channel, and it would be another report about how patients and carers at long-term treatment facilities would receive the initial course of protosilin and how vaccinations were being developed for the general public. They were the first news reports about tuberculosis that I could remember where the correspondents didn't look worried as they explained that the contagious illness known as TDR-TB had been declared an epidemic by the CDC 2 years ago, with more than 280,000 active cases reported across the United States alone this year. If anything, they looked hopeful, like the disaster was behind us and the scare was almost over. October was coming to a close, and I'd been at Latham House for 17 months. I'd missed the end of my sophomore year of high school. I'd celebrated my 16th birthday in the hospital playing Uno with my mom and sister while they wore surgical masks. And I'd been at Latham for almost a year and a half, longer than nearly everyone. I wasn't sure I knew how to leave Latham. I'd never let myself think for certain that I would, or when that might be. Except now everyone was saying we'd be home by January. I didn't know how to feel about any of it, or even what I was feeling, just that I was overwhelmed. No one said much of anything at dinner. We were all too busy thinking about what had just happened, and what it meant to have our futures slip back into place while we were sitting quietly at our desks, trying not to cough all over our notebooks. We were no longer incurably ill. And for so many of us, that had been our defining thing for so long. It had hurt to accept what was wrong with me, but it hurt even more to have hope. I didn't want protosilin to be real because I didn't want to go home to the dreary, unappealing life I'd left behind. I wanted Latham to stay Latham forever, for us to have a million more days of playing cards in the sunshine, and a million more nights of whispering into the phone and knowing that when I woke up, Lane would be waiting on my porch, his hair still wet from the shower. Latham was my Hogwarts, and protosilin was the cure for my magic. It would turn me into a muggle again, one who had to worry about standardized testing and mean girls and tardy slips.
After we bust our trays, Lane and I walked down to the lake. He kept glancing at me shyly, like he thought I wouldn't notice, and then he reached out and grabbed my hand. We walked like that down to the far edge of the lake with a sunken boat and lay on our stomachs in the grass. I looked over at Lane, at the nearly invisible white hairs that dusted his earlobes, at the freckle on the center of his neck, at how absolutely thrilled he seemed. And I told myself to quench this weird darkness that was twisting inside of me. So when he smiled and nudged me with his sneaker, I nudged back, forcing away my traitorous despair. We had the perfect view of Latham across the water, the half-moon of the cottages, the collegiate-looking classrooms, the dining hall with its stained-glass windows, the bell tower atop the gymnasium, and just a white corner of the medical building. "Do you think Latham's going to shut down?" I asked.
"Probably," Lane said. "Maybe it'll become a boarding school again and the students will tell ghost stories about the kids who died here."
"Maybe it'll become some terrible artist's colony with a bunch of nude ladies painting fruit," I suggested, not entirely kidding.
Lane shook his head, smiling. "We'll have to visit and check," he said. "We can get butterbeer lattes and everything."
I tried not to let my smile falter as I told him that sounded great.
"You live where again? Calabasas?" he asked, and I nodded. "That's like 85 miles. It's nothing. I'll be at your doorstep with bagels every Saturday morning."
"I didn't know you had a car."
"Oh, yeah, my dad's old Honda. It's covered in a million political bumper stickers, but it has spirit."
I smiled at the thought of him pulling up outside our condo and us driving to the beach or one of the canyons to have a breakfast picnic. It sounded so wonderful, like something I dreamed up. But part of me was afraid it wouldn't work, that he'd make the trip once or twice to be polite, and then he'd make excuses. "I can't believe we're talking about this," I said, "about being home 2 months from now and you showing up at my door."
"Well, I'd text first," he said.
The absurdity of having phones again and being able to text each other made me giggle. "It's so weird to think about any of it, about going back to high school," I said.
"Well, it's even weirder to think about college," Lane said. "I hadn't really wanted to get my hopes up, you know, before."
He went on to explain how he'd been afraid that Stanford wouldn't grant him housing and that Dr. Barron's might say he wasn't fit for full-time study and that he'd get sick again and have to drop out. But protosillin would change all that. Our lungs would suck, so we'd never be marathon runners or anything, but we'd live. I wished I was more excited about it, but all I could think was that I was going home for what should have been my last semester of senior year to a school I'd left as a sophomore. I was pretty sure I'd be held back since I doubted I could keep up with kids who'd taken pre-calc and chemistry. I'd be remedial when I used to make the honor roll. I didn't have my driver's license or even a permit. I hadn't taken the SATs or even started to study for them. None of those things had been a part of my world for so long that it was terrifying to find them rushing back toward me. My mom's new boyfriend, whom I'd never met but who my sister said was nice, apparently stayed over all the time. It weirded me out to think that there was some guy around who wasn't Dad, that the world hadn't been put on hold and things had changed, and an accountant named Drew had filled our fridge with protein shakes. Lane and I only had a few more weeks together before everything changed. A few more weeks to be the Latham versions of ourselves. And I was determined to make them count, to enjoy the last scraps of happiness while I could still pick them out of the rubble. I was certain that I wouldn't be cool and offbeat the way I was at Latham, the girl with the red lipstick and tough boots who talked back to the French teacher and made a joke out of the cafeteria rules, the girl with the camera and the contraband, always sneaking away with her friends like they were up to no good, always laughing the loudest and giving the impression that even alone in my room I was doing something interesting. All of that would be gone. Whoosh. And I'd be the weird new girl who'd been out sick for so long that everyone had forgotten about her. Even her family. My mom cried, although I could hear her smiling through the tears. She told me that my room was waiting for me and that she'd washed the sheets before I got home,
like my sheets had gotten up to all sorts of nefarious business while I was away. She said we'd go for tacos, and she couldn't wait for me to meet Drew. And Erica had a gymnastics meet right before Christmas, and I just had to see her floor routine. She sounded so happy that I went along with it, because from the way she was rambling, I had the impression that she'd prepared herself a long time ago, never to need to wash those sheets. I had an appointment with Dr. Behrens on Thursday so he could change the battery in my med sensor. It needed to be swapped out every couple of months, and the whole process made me feel like a robot. I'd had the sensor for so long that for the few months when it was off my wrist, I felt untethered, like something was missing. When I was younger, I'd had this star necklace I used to wear, which I never took off, not even to shower. My dad had given it to me. I'd unclasped it the night my parents told me they were getting a divorce, and I overheard them whispering about the truth, that my dad loved some woman from his office, apparently more than he loved us, because he'd rather be with her than his family. For the next week, I'd reach up to grab my star necklace, forgetting not just that I'd taken it off, but that I was no longer my father's North Star, and he no longer wanted to find his way home. Apparently, I'd been lost in thought because Dr. Behrens was like, "I'm going to need to put that back on you, sweetheart." "Oh, sorry." I held out my wrist, watching as he took out a tiny wrench and screwed on the plate that kept it shut. He smiled at me reassuringly, fiddling with the clasp. He screwed the back panel into place, but the green light didn't turn on. And he made a face. "Let me reset it," he said, taking a paperclip out of his pocket and inserting the end of it into one of the tiny holes on the side of my med sensor. He held it there until something clicked and then the green light flicked on. "These things shut off sometimes," he explained. "Just need a reset to get them going again." "Yep, Gatsby should be able to spot me now," I said, and Dr. Behrens smiled at me distractedly. "All set." Dr. Behrens took out his tablet, making sure I was back online. But then he furrowed his brow at the data. "Everything okay?" I asked, hopping off the exam table. "Your temperature's a little high," he said, scrolling down his tablet screen. "Heart rate, too." He swiveled toward the computer and typed something in, pulling up a series of x-rays and tabbing between them. "Are those mine?" I asked. Dr. Behrens nodded, then pivoted toward me on the stool. "Is anything wrong?" I asked. Dr. Behrens smiled at me.
"No, no. Nothing that a dose of protosilin won't fix."
Chapter 17. Lane. Latham had never felt more like a summer camp than it did in those first few days after news of the cure. Suddenly, everyone was talking about the future and making jokes about adding each other on Facebook. Camp Latham was almost over, and everyone was getting overly nostalgic about even the smallest things. Halloween was that Friday, and although Sadie had been joking about decorative gourd painting, I hadn't quite believed her. But it turned out she hadn't been kidding. The nurses set up tables outside the cottages and taped down about a million trash bags so we wouldn't make a mess. Charlie's was a masterpiece, and Marina's was a Dalek, which Nick flipped over and tried to copy while she glared at him. Of course, mine, a lopsided ghost thing, came out so badly that Sadie joked it was lucky I'd never taken an art class. "Take that back," I insisted, brandishing my paintbrush. "Nope, the grade still stands. D-. Goodbye, Stanford." I swiped my paintbrush at her, landing a dot on her cheek. She squealed and tried to wipe it off, but only smeared it bigger. "You're gonna get it now," Sadie said, leaning over and painting an orange stripe down my nose. And suddenly the five of us were in the middle of a paint fight, or I guess the four of us, while Charlie hovered protectively over his gourd, begging us not to wreck it. His gourd, like many civilians in war, was a casualty. "Exterminate?" Marina said innocently, holding her still-dripping paintbrush.
"Oh, I am going to kill you," Charlie said, staring at his mauled gourd.
And then he picked up his paintbrush and joined the fray. When it finally ended, Everyone was staring at us like we were crazy. And maybe we were. We were covered in paint and surrounded by smashed and sabotaged gourds. One of the nurses came over and got really angry about it, and I could still feel flakes of paint in my ear that night while we watched Hocus Pocus in the gym. "This movie is so lame," Sadie whispered, shaking her head. "I loved it when I was little, though," Marina said, and we all agreed that, yeah, we'd loved it when we were kids. Nick had booze for us again, but he said that was the last of it until they restocked on Friday. "We need some serious boozage for my birthday next Saturday," Marina said, and Nick promised he had it covered. Charlie had fallen asleep, and maybe it was the way he was curled around his pillow with his head thrown back, but his breathing sounded pretty ragged. "Is he okay?" I asked, nodding toward Charlie. Nick peered over at him. "He's fine. He always falls asleep during movies." "I think he stays up all night writing in that notebook," Sadie said. Nick nudged Charlie with his foot, and Charlie shifted, coughing a little in his sleep.
"Don't eat the walrus. It's poisoned," he muttered, his left foot twitching. "Yeah, he's good," Nick said.
We went back to watching the movie, which was pretty cheesy. It gave me flashbacks to the year of the gorilla suit, which I couldn't believe I'd told Sadie about. Way to seem cool, Lane. Way to make a girl fall in love with you. Up ahead of us, these three girls in pajamas and drawn-on cat's whiskers giggled at the screen, actually enjoying the movie. A group of boys eyed them. The boys were from Charlie's floor, and they passed around a Nalgene bottle, coughing like they were swilling straight alcohol. Next to me, Sadie sipped her juice box, our bare feet tangled together. Her toenails were painted blue, and her hair was down and wet from the shower, and she was so beautiful that I didn't know what I'd do when I couldn't see her every day, when I had to fall asleep catching up on my AP coursework instead of catching up with her. Sadie caught me staring and grinned. "Hey, trick or treat?" she asked. "Trick?" I said hopefully. "Too bad. I only have a treat." She pressed the last fun-sized Twix into my hand. I tore it open and the chocolate oozed out, getting everywhere. "It's all melty," I complained, and Sadie smiled sadly. "Not even chocolate lasts forever," she said. Charlie refused to hang out with us on Sunday night. He didn't have the bridge right on his new song, he said. It wasn't working, and no, he couldn't just leave it. He'd lose the momentum. So it was just Nick and me. Nick still wasn't happy about my dating Sadie, but he was getting better about it. I guess it didn't bother him as much now that we'd get out of here so soon. He talked constantly about how the girls back home would think he was so deep, and his biggest problem was going to be keeping up with all his ladies. I didn't want to ruin his fantasy, so I nodded and said, "Yeah, totally." That night, in a fit of nostalgia, Nick insisted that we play Mario Kart. Except he'd loaned his disc to Carlos from the second floor, so we went down to try and get it back. But Carlos couldn't find it. We stood there in the doorway while he sifted through the endless crap in his drawers looking for the thing. "I swear, I had it, like, this week," he said. "Hold on, there's only 5 places it would be." Carlos opened his wardrobe and started tossing stuff onto his bed, like he thought maybe he'd hung up Nick's disc by accident. Nick rolled his eyes over it. "We could play something else," I said. "You could show me the crossbow trick on that Bloodstakes game." And then we heard a shrill electronic beeping from another room. It sounded like an alarm clock or a timer, except louder and somehow more foreboding. Beep, 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 beep. Beep, 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 beep. Nick and Carlos stiffened immediately. "Shit," Carlos said, letting the sweatshirt he was holding fall to the floor. The beeping continued, and I wondered why no one turned it off and why everyone was reacting so strangely. "What's going on?" I asked. "Med sensor," Nick said grimly. My eyes met Nick's. He looked afraid. "Come on," he said, yanking me into the hall. The beeping continued. Other doors started to open, the residents of the second floor looking around. Some guys from the third floor had come down the stairs and were poking their heads over the banister. "Who is it?" someone asked. An Asian kid in a towel pushed open the door to the bathroom, shampoo still in his hair. "Chandler?" he called. "Not me, dude," a heavyset kid said. "Shit," Nick whispered. "The nurse is coming." Most of us were in the hallway at that point, rubbernecking, and Nurse Monica had to wade through it. Med sensors went off only if your vitals spiked pretty badly, if you needed immediate medical attention. Most of the time, anyone that sick was already staying in the medical building. "Move," she snapped. "You know better." "Where's Charlie?" I said. "Oh, God," Nick said, going pale. The beeping was coming from Charlie's room. Nick and I started pushing to the front, and I couldn't remember being more terrified. My heart was hammering, and I felt like I was going to throw up. It couldn't be Charlie, it couldn't be. Nurse Monica banged open the door. And there was Charlie, hunched over his desk, while two naked dudes went at it on his giant cinema display. From the huge bottle of lotion and his lack of pants, it was obvious what he was up to. The entire hallway was in hysterics. "Oh, oh," Nurse Monica said. Clearly, she'd been expecting a different kind of disaster. "Fuck," Charlie gasped. "Shut the door." "Yo, that's dude on dude," this guy Preston called out, thinking he was very astute. "Gross, turn it off," someone yelled. "More like turn it on," someone else said. "That's enough," Nurse Monica scolded. "Go away, back to your rooms." And then she barged into Charlie's room and shut the door. I could hear her in there, trying to calm him down while he yelped, "Get away, oh my God, I'm fine." "That," Nick said, "is probably my greatest fear."
"Is he going to be okay?" I asked.
"Oh, he'll never live it down," Nick said gleefully. And then he saw the look on my face. "Yeah, dude's fine. He just jerked off so hard he triggered his med sensor."
I thought that was an urban legend.
I mean, I'd never had that problem, and I assumed from the general activity on my hallway that it wasn't a usual thing. I'd heard some guys joking about it, but I'd figured it was just one of those freak-out-the-new-kid things.
"Nah, it happens sometimes. If you're, like, really going at it, the thing is not to rush. You've got to get your heart rate down just enough."
"Shut up," I said.
"You've got to do, like, yoga breathing," he continued.
"Seriously, shut up."
"Hey, I'm just giving you some free advice here," he said, "so you don't wind up being the next victim of the med sensor."
"No offense, but I don't want to think about you when I've got my dick in my hand."
"Aha," Nick accused. "Aha, so you and Sadie haven't yet made the tiny little love muffins." I didn't even know what to say in response, or why Nick thought our love muffins were so tiny. Maybe we had massive love muffins. How did he know?
"This really is the darkest timeline," I said, shaking my head as we walked back upstairs.
"Of course it is. We're all sick versions, except for Charlie, who's a sick gay version dumb enough to tilt his computer screen right at the freaking door," Nick said, shaking his head. "I wouldn't want to be him tomorrow."
From the way Charlie slunk into the dining hall the next morning, it was obvious he wanted to disappear. And I didn't blame him. The guys in our dorm were still laughing over his misfortune, and I was pretty sure the story was about to make the rounds if it hadn't already.
"What's going on?"
Marina asked suspiciously, narrowing her eyes at us.
"Nothing," I said, shrugging. But Nick must have smirked because Marina stared us down until he told her. "Charlie's sensor went off last night," Nick said, and then quickly took a huge bite of toast so he didn't have to say anything else. Marina gasped.
"Charlie, are you okay?"
Sadie asked, looking concerned. Charlie sank even lower in his seat until his chin was level with the table. He looked awful, like he'd been up all night.
"Don't want to talk about it,"
he mumbled. That guy Preston sailed past our table.
Hey, homo, hands where we can see him, he called, laughing.
Hey, Preston, you're an asshole, Nick called back. Charlie put his head down on the table and sighed.
Nick, Sadie said, sounding stern, tell us right now.
And so, laughing the entire time, Nick told them. When he was finished, Marina was grinning and Sadie was having a hard time keeping it together.
Just one of the many reasons why it's better to be a girl, Sadie said, which just about killed me, thinking of her doing that.
The entire floor saw, Marina said, like all of them?
75% plus Lane and me, Nick said.
It isn't funny, Charlie wailed. And it wasn't even Nurse Jim, it was Nurse Monica. She's like a mom.
She is a mom, Nick said. Her kids are adorable. I've seen